Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
No, he doesn't open his mouth.
Yeah, that's it. He's good.
Okay, fine. See, mine's not very good. All right. Oh, and I'll tell you beforehand, if you see me while we're talking doing this, I'm like IMDBing something.
Yes,
so I
understand. Good, because I would be doing the same thing if my internet was fast enough. For some reason, when I'm driving, it isn't.
But I wanted to...
What are you doing on the internet while you're driving?
Oh, I'm at stops. You know,
okay.
It doesn't come up. But I was trying to look up the first horror movie I ever saw. So,
anyway, they list that on the internet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Can you just
Google first horror film?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, are we on?
Not yet.
We're always on.
Let's not.
Are we on?
Let's not.
Oh, we are. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, let's not.
Wad, as they say.
This is a. He just
gave
it
away.
Oh, but we're on topic though. That sucks. I don't know. Well, you heard the Dana one. Like normally, we just sort of start with the kind of casual "How are you?" We don't tell people we're recording them because that's when we get them to say like the horrible, horrible things that.
Okay.
That we then edit out.
I love everybody.
And sit. I have a whole bin of terrible, terrible things guests have said. And, yeah, the incredible racist rants of Dana Gould.
Oh, stop.
That just go on for like an hour and a half, and then he goes on to women, and you're just like, Dana, we can't use any of this. Or Karaszewski.
Yeah.
Really bad. That guy is.
Oh, he's
hates everyone.
Complete bum.
And he just flips a switch, and he's like, hey, I'm Larry Karaszewski.
Odious. And his house is shit.
Oh, yeah.
Terrible.
It's terrible, terrible dumpster fire.
Must be trash.
I don't know who else has been on the show that we despise. Who is terrible? They're so bad. Yeah, we're coming up on 50.
Oh, fantastic!
Yes.
Congratulations.
Bill Hader was our 50th.
You're not supposed to.
Well, they're not going to use any
Chris,
of this.
Can you explain?
Look,
no,
he hasn't even got his
now. I have to cut that because I don't know when we're going to.
Well, but this won't appear until after Bill, right?
I'm not sure.
Oh, you never know.
Never know.
Don't say anything topical.
Well, now it can't.
All right. Now, you know those miners that are caught stuck in Chile, you know.
That school bus full of kids in Chowchilla.
Happen.
Anyway, I just, I don't know, I have a million jokes about.
Really? A million jokes?
About the fact
there goes our hour.
That we release our shows many weeks after we record them. But are we are up and running? This is The Movies That Made Me, with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
I was like to sort of prep for literally just the introduction of our guests and make sure I'm not missing anything. But then you sort of come across one where you're like, oh, all I have to say is we are here this week with Lorraine Newman. And I mean, that's.
Former groundling.
Josh.
And now the new June Foray, as far as I can see.
Yeah.
You do so much voice work. It's really remarkable.
It's the best job ever.
It is. You don't have to dress up. You don't have to do anything.
Yes, you work with incredibly generous and hilarious people. You act stupid. You get paid.
And the thing, I do an audio drama that I script. It's an enormous amount of work and so much fun, called Bronzeville with Lawrence Fishburne and Lawrence Tate. This incredible cast. And it's like old-time radio drama.
Uh-huh.
And they do it, you know, we do it in the room. It's not like people are doing their lines separately. And it's so much fun watching actors when they come in on their first day. Because I don't have to tell you, you know, you get out of your car and a minute later, you're sitting in a room doing scenes with, you know, Lawrence Fishburne or whoever. And people just love it. And then you're done. You go home. There's no waiting. You know, there's no construction. There's no lighting.
It's like being in a pickup band.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, but it's just doing the work and nothing else. And it's like
there's a show I do called Celebrity Autobiography. It's a stage show. It's been on Broadway. But basically, you're reading from celebrities' autobiographies.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, how, oh, God rest her soul, Florence Henderson would read like Mr. T.
Oh, fantastic.
Things like that, you know.
How did I miss this?
It's a great show, but it's like being in a pickup band because you can just throw anybody into it.
Right, right. Well, it seems like the work is the casting, right?
Yes.
Like you have to get the, yeah. Is that still, does that still go on?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
In New York, though?
Everywhere. Oh. All over the world, but yeah, we do it here in LA too.
Oh wow, I have to keep my eyes peeled.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing. I also before we get into it, I need to thank you, I guess, for something. I've had two times in my life where I have laughed so hard. In fact, the first time I've talked about on the show was at I think it was Night at the Opera. And I ended up in the hospital the next day with a doctor going over because my mother thought I had appendicitis and it didn't seem to. And the doctor said, were you laughing a lot? And I had been in the march. The only other time I felt close to that much pain was there. It's hard to find. There was a SNL special with you and Gilda and Bob and Ray.
Oh, yeah.
And
Bob and Ray, Jane, Lorraine, and Gilda.
That was it. Yes. And, yeah. And Jay Curtin. And something about it, and I found a video of it a little while back and watched it, and it had the same effect.
So you literally bust a gut.
The Rod Stewart.
Yeah,
song.
If you
they
think I'm
do,
sexy.
Do you think I'm sexy?
Yeah.
And I remember my friend's house, and I've never literally, I mean, you pretend, I fell out of a chair.
Aww.
And I was hunched over on the floor in pain. Have you seen this
Aww.
Bit?
She sits alone, waiting for suggestions.
Well, it's all Franken and Davis. You know, they were huge Bob and Ray fans.
Oh, sure.
So it was their dream to write that special.
That was amazing. I'm sure it was my introduction to them.
Mm-hmm.
But that
I used to listen to them on the radio and in the East Coast all the time.
Well, you're a little older than
I'm a little older.
You yes. lucky.
Yeah. Tiny bit. But anyway, Lorraine, thank you for coming.
It is my pleasure.
We are thrilled
Love
to have you.
Love talking about movies.
No, great. And then Joe, I didn't know this, and I apologize. And I mentioned it to Joe, and Joe goes, everyone knows that. And I was like, I did not know you were a big science fiction horror freak.
Yes,
I am. And apparently that's on me.
No, it's legendary in the fan community.
I thought I was part of that community.
He's winking, everybody, just so you know.
I'm not.
He's
I'm
winking and nudging I've always, Josh I've in
I've known
the
it.
Ribs.
I've known it since the since you were on SNL with Christopher Lee.
Because did you know?
Because I remember reading something that you had said after, but how what a great experience
well,
this was.
Also, I had lobbied for him to be a host for
That's
2
right.
years.
Yes.
But it wasn't until he was in a James Bond movie
right.
that they had him host. But he was so wonderful. I mean, he did announce upon, you know, arriving that he won't be doing Dracula. It's like, oh, no. But he more than made up for
it. Not even privately?
He was a great rock on tour and very gregarious and very game.
Fantastic. Yeah, we talked about
he played Death.
Yeah,
well, in the classic sketch.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. No, I remember. And then I think was it Dana we were talking about him with recently? We talked about Serial.
Yeah,
because Christopher Lee in the movie Serial, the Martin Mull film, is so devastatingly
funny. I don't know
that
movie.
Plays a gay biker.
Oh, it's 1980. It somehow got just lost in the shuffle. It's
uh-huh.
based on a wonderful book. It's Martin Mull, Bill Macy, Tommy Smothers.
Jesus.
I mean, you can't believe the cast in this thing. And Christopher Lee playing, I don't even want to give anything away. You need to see it.
I think I've seen the picture of him as the gay biker.
That's right. You've given
and
it away.
Didn't
but
know
yeah,
what
he,
it was from.
He leads a group of gay bikers. And,
oh, it's fabulous. Fabulous.
Yes.
It's fabulous.
Bill Persky, right?
What?
Bill Persky?
Did he direct
I think he directed it.
Oh, did
it?
He? I don't remember.
He did. I know he wrote it.
It's a movie I love. But yeah, there's so many. He's phenomenal.
Oh, I have to check
he's
that
absolutely
out.
Hilarious. And the movie's great, too. But you came to talk to us about,
yes.
You were just going to run us through a list of 10 of your favorite, was it horror films, science fiction films, just in general?
It was both.
Kind
you
of
know,
both, yes.
Mainly horror. There are a few science fiction classics like Godzilla, Well, actually, and the first horror movie I ever saw, my twin brother and I were 4 years old. And I don't know who it was that took us to this movie. And I had always remembered the title being X-76 Blood Rust. But that was, the title was actually Space Commander 76.
Space Master.
Space Master. There you go.
It seemed incredible that the microscopic material that Space Master X-7 brought back to Earth from outer space could grow into this crawling, pulsating, thinking mass of protoplasmic evil.
As the specimens grow, their need for nourishment also increases. Because of its color, I call this organism Blood Rust.
It was the second feature to The Fly.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and it...
And everybody always called it Blood Rust.
Because that was, I think... What
because
they,
that's what Paul Frees is a scientist, and he creates this stuff, yes, which is basically rubber that they lay all over the set. But it's very toxic, and it's bad, and it gets on an airplane.
Right.
And it's one of those pseudo-documentary style pictures where there's scientific investigators who go to different places with the trains and planes and stuff all shot in real locations. And it's a very interesting
movie. And to see Paul Frees as an actor, too.
Oh, he's did a lot of movies. Yeah, actually was in a lot of pictures, yes. He's in Suddenly. He's Frank Sinatra's henchman who gets shot. He's in His Kind of Woman. He's really, if you look at his filmography, he did a lot of acting, as did Marvin Miller, who was also a big voiceover guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mo Howard is also in.
And Mo Howard.
What?
Space right. Commander.
He's
playing a straight role?
Yes, he's a taxi driver.
A cab driver.
Does he have the...
I can't believe you know this stuff.
Huh?
I am so impressed that you know
this. Oh, wait, watch this. This is my favorite thing to do. Joe has seen every movie.
I have not.
And then
no one
that.
Has seen every movie.
You have.
But you know that movie.
Of course I do. I saw it when I was a kid. It was a classic.
Yeah.
What's the running time, Joe?
72 minutes.
Uh-oh.
Oh, my God.
It's 72 minutes?
No, we caught Joe off. Joe, you were wrong.
What is it?
71.
We don't need the internet.
Don't count the logo.
I think we can wrap the show
you
up.
Don't we count finally, the logo.
We...
There you go. Gotcha.
That's fine. And so wait, so you were a child and you're...
Yeah, I was...
But you saw this on a single bill?
Or to the best of my recollection, yes. But I don't...
That's the
I
kind
was
of movie
four.
Hardly ever played.
You know, I don't remember.
Maybe they just took you out before The Fly came up.
It could have been. I love The Fly also. And love Cronenberg's remake because I love Cronenberg. In fact, Howard Shore, who was the musical director of SNL's band, took me to my first Cronenberg movie, which was The Brood, which is just so brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, the whole idea that this kind of malevolence could come as a result of psychotherapy is just brilliant. Just wonderful.
Scientology throwback.
Yeah. And as he and I actually am fond of reminding people that that is the best movie about divorce to come out that year.
That's great.
Kramer versus Kramer was the other, but I would.
Wow.
I always think of Kramer versus Kramer as the picture with the out of focus shot.
Oh.
You know, there's a major scene between Streep and Hoffman, and Hoffman is out of focus.
Really?
And they said, oh, Dustin, you know, this is we really have to do this over. He said, I'm not doing it over. I can't do any better. That's the best I can do. It's my best performance. So, but Dustin, everybody will look at it. They won't see your performance. They'll see the fact that it's out of focus. And he refused to reshoot it.
Wow.
And it's in the movie that way.
Wow.
Is it still effective?
It's out of focus.
Can't see anything else.
I don't know. I never noticed. So maybe I did. I don't know. I only saw it in theaters once. It was not my favorite divorce movie that year.
Josh is getting a call, everyone.
Hi, honey. Would you like to say hello to Lorraine Newman?
Hello, Lorraine Newman.
Hello. Who am I talking to?
It's my wife, Nancy.
Hi, Nancy.
I can't hear anything.
We're recording. Is it urgent?
Jesus, I
think that's why. She always calls in.
She never does. I've been waiting for that to happen forever. That made my day.
But, you know, the thing about that, what I remember about Space Commander was that it was made in something that looked like a Sparklets bottle, but it wasn't. It came from outer space, and it looked like basically vomit. And the denouement is it trying to force its way through the baggage hold of a plane and everybody freaking out. And the only thing that would kill it was fire. And I think they cornered it in some boxcar or something, or just, yeah. It's all these great shots of downtown LA too.
Oh, really?
Which I always love. And you know, I developed this love of going to a movie where I had to cover my eyes and part my fingers to see through. You know, it just stayed with me always.
Yeah, I remember years later as an adult wondering, as I was doing that, what is happening here that somehow if I only see the movie through my fingers, it won't be as terrifying.
Yeah, well, my twin brother slept with a nightlight till he was 14 because of Space Commander.
Oh, wow, really?
And it was that whole premise of if you have the covers over your head, you can't be harmed.
Right.
You know, so he it with just his nose exposed so he could breathe.
You should tell, your brother's name.
Paul Newman. Yeah.
Oh, such a fan.
Thanks. Oh my God, thanks. I'll tell him.
That was intentional?
No. We're 67. So Paul Newman really did that career then.
Yeah. Wow. So how did he feel about that?
Well, you know, we were listed and we lived in Beverly Hills.
Oh no.
And people would call his number a lot. We couldn't believe people would think he would be listed
in the phone book.
But, you know, it was usually people from the South.
Right.
And I guess, I don't know what to say about that.
I'm just imagining.
I have to put those words right back in my mouth.
You know, it can't hurt to try. Let's try. And then you find Paul Newman is listed in Beverly Hills. And
yeah.
I don't know, but what are you going to say to him? I don't know what did they say?
I love Jim Cole and Luke.
Yeah. I don't know.
You were in that, right?
Yeah.
No, but you should see me surf.
So that was the first movie.
But you were afraid while you were.
Oh, terrified. But I mean, that's the thing. And I think it's true for everybody who likes horror movies. Is that they're in much more trouble than you will ever be in.
Right.
And you're warm and comfortable and you've got popcorn and let them be in trouble, you know? But I saw, you know, all of the classic Universal pictures on TV.
Right.
And do you remember that logo that was glass with the plane flying?
Yeah,
glass.
The airplane flying. Mm-hmm.
I was so young when I started doing this that I thought every movie that had that opening was going to be a horror movie.
Oh, fantastic.
And I would sit through and it was like, that cowboy's not scary. Why are they kissing? You know, I just didn't get it. You know, and I'd sit through it and wait, nothing.
Oh, I feel that pain somehow. That's so great. Yeah, I love that logo. I mean, but that's short. I also think it's either going to be a horror film or some kind of crime movie, which is.
Oh, they made a lot of different kinds of movies.
They what?
Made a lot of different kinds of movies.
Yeah, but those are the good ones.
There's a documentary on Carl Laemmle that's coming out that's amazing.
Really?
And it shows them building Universal Studios and what the landscape looked like before.
Oh.
And Carl Laemmle trying to beat out the obstructive nature of Thomas Edison, who had all these patents. It was like stopping people at every turn. And so that's why he moved out to California, to just get away from all of that. But these movies, these horror movies, really put them on the map.
Yeah.
And there's one movie in particular, and I know you're going to know this movie, which is The Black Cat.
Did you ever hear of Satanism, the worship of the devil, of evil? Approaching the great modern priest of that ancient cult. And tonight, dark of the moon, the rites of Lucifer are celebrated. And if I'm not mistaken, he intends you to play a part in that ritual. A very important part.
And it was 1934, and it was before the Hays Code and stuff like that. And it is unbelievable, the plot. But the art direction, too, is just magnificent. Help me remember, because there's war crime involved, and it's World War I, Bela Lugosi.
It's post-World War I, and Bela Lugosi has come back to get revenge on this guy who took away his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he has built his Art Deco modern house on the ruins of a war. A battle. There was a battle, and
yes.
And so there's a feeling of death. It's one of the most morbid movies that anybody's ever made. And Edgar Ulmer, who is the director, was unfortunately, his career was affected by the fact that he was sleeping with somebody's wife at the studio.
Wow.
And that put the kibosh on him. And he couldn't make any more pictures for major studios for many, many years.
Wow.
But also, it's just, it's such a European movie. I mean, it's a very strange, the characters are very odd and weird. And it was so effective when they finished it that they had to reshoot parts of it because it was just too dark.
To tone it down.
And originally, Karloff and Lugosi were both villains. And in the reshoot, Lugosi becomes the nominal hero type and saves the girl and all that. And he's great in it. It's one of his best
roles.
They
both are, but there was also some implication.
Incest.
There's
incest, yeah.
Oh, but I think he, also Karloff was responsible for certain war crimes. I could swear that there's somehow that's implied.
I do a Halloween marathon every year, and we kicked it off with that this past year.
Oh, really?
I don't remember. Memory's hazy, but I mean, it played so well.
Yeah. There's a digital clock in it. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's got great music.
Yes.
All classical music. It's really, really scored well.
I think Peter and the Wolf is used in a lot of early Universal horror.
That makes sense.
Or is it Swan Lake?
Swan Lake.
I'll be all right. Swan Lake. Yeah.
Peter and the Wolf's good too.
I'm hearing Peter. Okay.
And then The Mummy too. The look of that movie, and especially when he has his reincarnated lover, you know, ready for sacrifice, and what she's wearing is basically two ribbons covering her nipples. That's it.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. And I was amazed by that, even as a kid, just seeing that. And there's something titillating about these movies as well. There's another movie that I really loved called Caltiki, which was an Italian movie. I never realized it was dubbed because, again, I was very young. But, you know, I watched the trailer recently and it's like, men devoted to them, women give them their beauty, you know, and you see this woman undulating on the ground.
Ages ago, in a long-lost part of the world, the Mayans worshipped a terrifying goddess. To her, men offered their strength and their devotion. Women offered the beauty of their bodies. Caltiki, the immortal monster.
And it's so good. The special effects are really good.
And Mario Bava did those special effects.
Oh, yeah? Oh, my God. This guy.
Yeah, no, it's yeah.
Misspent youth. Caltiki was, everybody thought it was a Mexican movie because it was obviously a foreign film and it takes place in Mexico. So everybody assumed for years that it was a Mexican movie, but it's actually an Italian movie. And with a nominal English star and everybody else is, you know, Italian. Mm-hmm. And they used to Americanize the names so that people, they would fool people into thinking they were American movies.
Uh-huh.
And
the actors, you mean?
Yeah, they used to change the names.
Yeah. Mark Stone.
You mean in the credits?
In the credits, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was many years before some of the real people got actual credit. And they did that with Italian Westerns. They did that with any import that they wanted to pass off as not European, they would just anglicize the names.
Wow.
And the names are always so goofy in their Americanness, you know.
Sergio Leone became Bob Roberts.
Yeah. Yeah.
What? That's beautiful.
Joe Williamson. What's the running time on that, Joe? Do you know?
Shut up.
I've never done that to him before. That was impressive. I'm kind of boggled. Do I assume that you go back to these movies?
I don't like seeing things that I've seen before.
Oh, right. Okay.
But there are a few exceptions, like Poltergeist, The Ring. There's also a movie called Where, W-E-R, for werewolf, that I've seen three times.
Oh, what a good boy. What's he doing?
Peter, stay close to your dad.
An American man and his young son were brutally killed last night.
There is no factual evidence to indicate anything more than an animal attack.
At 1452, we apprehended the suspect.
The man accused of these crimes, one Talon Gwinnick.
He had hair all over his hands. They were huge. He was tearing my boy to pieces.
He's my client. I'm defending him.
There's a very rare disease called porphyria. And the symptoms include excessive body hair, joint pain, muscle weakness.
People that have this can barely move.
It will prove that you were not capable of committing these crimes.
Thank you.
It's an American movie, but it's set in France. There are French actors. There are British actors. It is so good. And the guy who is the werewolf is the bass player of the band Eagles of Death Metal.
What?
Yeah. And he's so good. Yeah, and he speaks French in the movie. So you just assume he's a French actor. But he's from Palm Springs, dude. You know, it's just, but it is so good and has so much. I wish that they would do a follow-up to it because they set the stage for a sequel for sure.
Now, where did you see this?
On Apple TV.
It's 2013.
I troll for stuff on Apple TV.
Well, yeah, you have to. I mean, it used to be that when movies got released, everybody knew about it. There were fewer movies then too, but now there's everything today that we have, you know, not only all the old movies that we can see that we could never see before, but all the new movies that are coming out. And because of the distribution systems now and the fact that very few of these things play in theaters and very few people see them in theaters, there are all these movies floating around that you just don't know exist, you know, which is part of what we do on Trailers
from Hell. Is that the case with Mandy?
Mandy.
I mean, didn't
ding, 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 ding.
I never realized how happy you made me, oh man.
Remember, twice in a row.
Do you remember
on, have a theatrical release?
It did. But do you remember on Groucho's show, they used to have this duck that came down when somebody said the secret word?
Okay.
Well, we need to do that.
The last couple of episodes, I've refrained from mentioning it because Joe gives me grief because I bring up Mandy almost every episode. I was obsessed with it. I think it's an amazing film. We had the director come on, and our last guest brought it up on his own, and now you brought it up on your own. And I'm just, I'm innocent here.
It's like a plot.
Do you dislike that movie?
No, I don't dislike it, but it's just so bizarre to me that this movie that is actually not that popular is become so
horror fans. If you come up with something that you haven't seen before,
which is hard,
it's very hard, and they do that with Mandy. So you know, props to them.
I'll send you a link if you want to see it. I felt it had to be there because I kept waiting for it to show up in the movie, and it didn't. I barely edited. I took one of the trailers of the film, and I laid Barry Manilow's Mandy over it, and I did one little mix thing to bring up one line of dialogue, and then went back to that. But it plays, you can't believe, I sent it to Panos, the director, and he was knocked. It's like, you can't believe how perfectly it syncs up with it.
Oh, wow.
And the crazy thing is, I put it out on social media and this is a couple months ago, and then somebody pointed out, somebody else had done the exact same thing 6 months earlier.
Oh, geez.
It begs
It's in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, somehow. Wow. But I love Mandy. That one actually, the thing with that is that it did better than anyone thought it would. It started out on VOD in like two theaters or something, and then word of mouth was so strong it kept.
So it had a small theatrical release.
Well, it got bigger and bigger.
It was intended to be small, as horror movies tend to be. I'll give them 10 theaters and then we'll put it out on, you know. But you know, if it sings to people, then obviously they keep it.
It played more theaters the second week than it did the first, which is amazing. That never happens.
Wow.
But Where? So am I gathering that you were not familiar with Where?
No, I'm not.
Wow.
I'm not.
Do me a favor.
Where would I, would I have found out about it?
I don't know. Where do you, through the.
Did you, were you familiar?
No. This never happened.
He asked that question as if he knew about it and I didn't.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm perfectly happy.
Troll, you know, things like Apple TV, you will find. Yeah. You know,
had someone, that's the best though.
No.
But don't you need a recommendation? Because if you're going to troll and it just tells you, this is the movie that we're running, and you don't know anything about it,
you have to
just take a shot, you know.
I'm happy to have a recommendation, but a lot of these I just find.
So
I look at the synopsis, I look at the trailer.
That's the greatest thing
and
ever.
I know. I love that. Well, this is not on the subject, but I go to Coachella often, And in the early years, it was dusk. The sky was pink. The temperature was like amniotic fluid. And I heard this band and I wandered over to them and it was an orchestra. A guy was playing a stand-up bass with a drumstick and another guy was playing the electric guitar with a violin bow, and it was Sigur Rós.
Oh, wow.
And they're from Iceland. They're just, yeah. And you know, they use their music a lot for soundtracks also. Mm. But, you know, nobody had told me about them. Nobody had recommended right. them to me. It's a great way to come to something.
Yeah. Oh no, it's the best. It's the best. I find, especially with movies now on digital media, there's so much there that, you know, in the old days, just walking into a theater, you know, there's a decent chance.
And there were posters.
Yeah, there's posters and stuff. There's a possibility, but the odds are so far against you if you're just... I think I've talked about this before. Netflix used to have the thing where you'd pull up a movie and they'd have, if you like this, you might like these, mm-hmm. like five other movies.
They do that on Apple TV.
They do that on Apple, yeah. Yeah. What I used to do is I would drop down. I click on that, then I drop down again, and I just go down the deepest, darkest
hole.
Oh, it's
a great rabbit hole.
Until you get to like a list of movies that just you can't even believe really exist, and then watch yeah. one of them. But it's never worked out for me.
Well, because they are usually bad.
I'm so jealous.
I mean, that rating system is pretty accurate. What I've from my experience.
What's the?
It's like percentages, okay. Rotten Tomatoes, and you can drop down and see the theatrical reviews. Yeah. Variety, Hollywood Reporter, LA right. Times, Chicago Sun.
Well, I found a friend of mine, to be honest, but you have to learn how to, like, a 99% for a Marvel movie means it's terrible.
Oh,
you have to get 100.
Just,
but a 32% for a horror film means it's almost certainly pretty damn good. Yeah. It's like there's different kind of
You have
numbers.
To know how to read it.
Have to know how to read the numbers on Rotten Tomatoes, yeah.
But also, the Rotten Tomatoes, they cheat all the time. I mean,
well, that too.
They'll give a splat. You know, and then you'll read the review, and actually, it's a good review. And yeah. then sometimes they'll give a big tomato, and it's actually the guy didn't like the movie at all. Right. He said one line about it, which they quote, and then they give it an okay.
Yeah.
So I think there's stuff going on there. I think
there is stuff going on.
Some money
I've heard
exchanged.
Some other people say that about Rotten Tomatoes, that it's not to be trusted.
Well, Metacritic is the more accurate one where they actually read them. And I mean, it's insane that it's crazy.
Metacritic?
But critics,
Metacritic.
But if it's a new movie, it doesn't matter. Nobody, right. What people say about a movie when it's new has nothing to do with what they're going to say about it 10 years later.
And then there's that.
You know?
I'm so psyched, though. I'm always looking, you know, I curate this big Halloween marathon. I've got a big screen at home and a bunch of friends come over. We pack the place. We watch horror movies for a solid day. Mm-hmm. And I'm always looking for, I like to throw in some more, you know, we did Black Cat was in there last year, but I always want to find something new that's completely unknown. So I think where we'll have to go in there. And I just found out it's coming out in time for this. The Danzig film will be out in October.
What film is that?
You know about this. Do you not know about this?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Joe Dante on Twitter tweeted about it. So
well, give me more than that word.
Glenn Danzig, the heavy metal singer, has made a horror anthology film called Neurotic.
Yeah.
That is apparently the most, just jaw-droppingly awful thing you've ever seen, and is being compared favorably to The Room. And sounds.
Oh, well, I mean, they know their audience.
Well, he apparently, there's this one, you know, he comes out to the first screening of it. And I think the first thing he said was like, well, you all laughed at places I wouldn't have, but okay. Not quite getting it. And now a couple of weeks later, he's embraced the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it looks like
that's what we meant it to be that.
Yeah. Yes. But
oh gosh,
yeah,
what's the title again?
Verotic with a K.
Oh,
yes,
my gosh. Wow. Well, you know, just anybody can make a movie,
it's true these days. Yeah.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow. Well, there's another movie in Antonio Banderas where he's a plastic surgeon. Mm. Have you seen that one? What's the title of that?
Isn't that Almodovar?
Yeah, yeah. Is it under
Almodovar?
Oh my God, I'm losing my mind.
The director? I don't think,
I think so.
Yeah, is it Under the Skin?
Under the Skin?
Yeah.
Skin I'm in.
The Skin I'm In.
What the this is embarrassing.
Something with Skin in the title.
Look it up.
I'm looking it up. Here we go.
But that's definitely a horror movie.
Yeah, it is. It is a horror movie. But there's a whole tradition of plastic surgery horror movies. In fact, my episode of Nightmare Cinema, which just opened on Friday, is a plastic surgeon horror movie.
What is Nightmare Cinema?
It's an anthology with five directors.
How can I see it?
You could go to the Arena Cine Lounge on Sunset where it's playing, or you can, it's on VOD.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
I've got to write that down.
It is.
I love your work, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
The Howling blew my mind because, you know, you think that nobody can treat that topic in a unique way and just you watch. Yeah. You know, I always appreciate that, as I've said.
Oh, it's as I said, it's hard to do. When I saw Cabin in the Woods, I thought, you know, this is a movie that starts out being what we think it is, and then it completely becomes something different. And the first episode of Nightmare Cinema, which I did not direct, it starts out as the last reel of a slasher movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have any setup. You don't have any, you don't know who the people are. You don't know what's going on. Some of the girls running away. You don't know from what. And then there are twists that take place within it. It's only 25 minutes long, that are so unexpected and clever that, it just reminded me again, how great Cabin in the Woods was, because they completely turned on its ear all your expectations while still giving you what you wanted.
Oh yeah.
And that's the hard thing.
Yes.
Genre audiences want certain things or they wouldn't keep going back to see the same movies over and over. But if you just give them what they think they want, they're kind of disappointed. But if you can find a way to get a different take on it and to get into that area in a new way that illuminates something about the genre, then they love it. But the irony is Cabin in the Woods was on the shelf for like 2 years.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that trope of, you know, the young people on a road trip, you're right away. It's like, oh God, not this again. But they managed to even, you know, rope you in with that. I don't really know how they did that, but I really appreciated, and I guess this is under the category of giving people what they want, but they had every monster every movie you've ever seen and then some. And then the idea that there's something below that, an existential something, is just brilliant. So brilliant.
It is, by the way, The Skin I Live In.
Oh, okay.
That's very creepy. That's his only foray into anything like that.
The other stuff has been pretty light.
I mean, he's done darker stuff too, like Matador, but it's never been.
No, then I would call that a horror film.
Yeah, no, I'm saying it gets darker, but it isn't that horrific. So you don't go back. For instance, have you seen, I apologize, there were so many titles, Blood Rust.
Spacemaster X7.
I did.
Have you seen that as an adult?
Yes, I have. I saw it relatively recently. That's how I know Mo Howard is in it.
Was that pleasurable?
It was. I really enjoyed it. And I was stunned because I have never seen Paul Frees in a movie. You know,
You don't, you have, but you didn't notice him.
Oh, okay.
But he's pretty ubiquitous, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So his voice is certainly ubiquitous.
Guess, Joe, that's awesome.
I mean, when you attune yourself to the timbre of Paul Frees' voice, you can hear him in so many movies as you know, announcements on the radio, sometimes as characters who are completely dubbed by him. In Blood and Black Lace, all the male characters practically are dubbed by Paul Frees.
Oh my
God. In all these scenes, these seven guys are standing there and they're all talking to each other and they're all Paul Frees.
Is he augmenting his voice?
He changes his pitch. He does, you know, a bit, but it's basically still his voice. I mean, once you recognize his voice, you can pick it up.
Well, my first introduction to his voice is the Monsanto ride at Disneyland.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That's the first time I ever heard it.
Yeah. And then he did. And then he did the Haunted Mansion and Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
And every so often they phase out one of his phrases and put something else by somebody else, and people get mad and say, what happened to the real voice? You know. Aww. And he's been gone for God, a long time.
I know.
Wait, I can't. Is he? Oh God, I should know this. Is he the alternate voice in Dark of the Sun for the Nazis?
Yes, he is.
That is okay, yeah.
Which they don't use every time.
They switch it out.
They switch back and forth.
Rod Taylor mercenary movie with Jim Brown from the 60s called Dark of the Sun, and there's a Nazi character.
Great.
It's really
good. Oh, it's great. He's got a chainsaw fight.
Oh yeah.
With Nazis.
And there's this Nazi guy, this blonde guy, who for some reason, I don't know if there was something wrong with the recordings and they couldn't get him back, but sometimes he talks in his regular voice, and other times, every time he opens his mouth, it's Paul Frees. And in Some Like It Hot, all of Tony Curtis's performance as a woman is dubbed by Paul Frees.
But
my mouth is agape.
Wait, I think you said this before, and I've traumatically erased it.
It's absolutely true.
He's dubbed
every
over.
Time Tony Curtis opens his mouth as a woman, Paul Frees comes out. And you can tell because the background noise goes away.
Oh my God, I love knowing that.
I don't know if I do.
Well, Tony didn't seem to mind.
Well, yeah, he was getting paid.
Apparently, he didn't do a very good female voice.
I mean, I got a Billy Wilder was his decision. It does not compare with that, but I worked for Guillermo del Toro on a cartoon, and I found out that the sets in Shape of Water were repurposed sets from, The Strain.
Oh, that would make sense because he produced that.
It's your little tidbit.
Yeah.
And just, I love knowing that.
That's kind of wonderful. That's, I know you've said that before. It somehow it just
I didn't say it. It's true.
There are Nazi zombie movies too.
Oh, sure.
There are Shockwaves.
Yeah, Shockwaves.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And a lot of great Swedish ones too. Swedish. Oh, noir recent. And horror, so good.
Yeah, what's the, there is a recent Swedish.
The Iron something. Iron.
No, the one about the Nazis in the snow.
Yeah, I can't remember the title, but I sure as hell have watched it.
We're going to be that podcast. Yeah. Hey, you see that movie with the thing? Oh, yeah, with the guy?
Yeah, the thing with the guy in the place.
Snow Nazis.
Yeah, what's that called? I don't know. It's got snow Nazis.
Well, people can write in. You know, he's asking these questions.
Yes, actually, we did that on my marathon. Yeah, that was wonderful. The movie with snow Nazis is great. I'm glad you liked it.
Dead Snow. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Let the Right One In was a Swedish horror.
For sure.
Their thrillers are great too, but really dark. Avenue Q, the trilogy, or not Avenue, Department Q.
Yes.
Is that dark?
Cop stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's just so dark because they're serial killers.
Mm. Yeah.
They're just imaginative.
Isn't it always night there?
It seems like
it's either always night or always
and
day.
It's certainly always cold.
It's always cold.
And
yes.
Cold really lends itself to horror, don't you
it
think?
It does.
Yeah. Or 30 Days of Night, which I also was a great premise, at least.
I went to the Midnight Sun Film Festival in Denmark, I think.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun right there.
It's horror movies, but it's daytime all the time, except when it's night, and then it's night.
Right.
But it is so disorienting that you really start to wonder whether you should get up and leave the bed because you just don't know. It's worse than jet lag because you know you're not going anywhere, you're not traveling, you're just in a place. Also, there's a lot of mosquitoes.
Oh, I hate that. It's like that Al Pacino movie that takes place in life. I'm sorry?
The Chris Nolan one.
Okay.
No, the one they remade.
Yeah, that's a remake.
Yeah.
Oh, it is?
Chris Nolan. Here we go again. You know, the one with the thing where Al Pacino can't sleep. That movie, it's great. Yeah, no, Chris Nolan remade it. It's with Robin Williams.
Right. It's very palpable.
I want to say Indonesia, not Indonesia.
Sleepless in Indonesia.
Insomnia. Insomnia, Indonesia.
You know, that thing where you can't sleep.
But yeah, it's a remake of a Swedish.
But
his
discomfort is really palpable.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that is slowly, you know, he has to contend with headaches and the lack of sleep and all this stuff while trying to, you know, outwit this foxy serial killer. So good. So effective.
Yeah. Oh, agreed.
I'm trying to think of some things that I've seen recently that are good.
Always tough.
Oh, no. It's the problem. But do you find, and I keep wondering, is it like, is it I'm getting older or is it just there's so much input now that it's far more common to have the experience we've actually been having for the last 5 minutes of trying to remember the name of a movie I saw a week ago.
I know.
Even if I really liked it.
Yeah. I'll try this. What's, you know, they just run a bunch of trailers.
Uh-huh.
Name one.
What?
Name a trailer that you saw
at the theater.
I mean, they just, they're all, first of all, they're all the same trailer.
Right.
And after you leave, it's, because I always ask people, so what were the trailers? What's coming?
Yeah.
Nobody can remember.
Right.
But you did see them, right?
Yeah, sure.
I saw them, but I don't remember.
And I make a point of getting there in time to see them.
I'm always with someone that says, well, I've now seen the movie.
Right.
Which you haven't, you know?
Yes.
There's still more to find out.
Although I just saw last night for some, we were about a 10-minute long trailer for some 60s giallo film that I actually believe there's nothing left to see. It's just this endless, they made some long trailers.
They did. The Italians were very big on long trailers.
And yeah, this, but by minute five, you're just going, I'm done. I'm enough. Uh-huh. And it just keeps going.
Wow.
Which I feel like is the exact opposite of what you want to instill in your audience.
No, that's why. When I worked for Roger Corman, we used to do teasers.
Yes.
Which is just a 60-second. Trailer,
those
which
are great.
the theater would get for free because it was a teaser, and then they'd have to pay for the trailer. And what Roger would do, he did on Death Race 2000. We did a trailer for Death Race 2000, and he didn't like it because he always thought the picture was too silly,
right.
And the trailer made it look silly. He said, "Well, let's just send them back the teaser." And I said, "Yeah, but now they have to pay for it." He said, "They won't know," and he was right. He didn't know.
You know, he's incredible. That guy.
He is.
I actually went back and looked. I know he is. I went back and looked at a lot of his movies too, and The Tangler. You know,
The Tangler is William Castle.
Oh shit, that's right.
No, he did the Edgar Allan Poe movies with
Vincent
Price.
That's right.
But great too. So I there was a. We talked about this. There was a period. A Cinefamily several years ago did a William Castle festival. And
they wired the seats.
Well, there's a guy, Jordan Rosa, who's this mad genius, figured out how to do all the, because they didn't leave behind instructions.
That's fantastic.
And they actually wired the seats for the Tangler. Well,
they did leave behind instructions.
There's
I have a copy of the press book they sent
for
to the exhibitors.
Actual instructions?
Yeah.
Like how to wire the seats.
And believe me, it's a big deal. I mean, it's many pages. And the trick is they're like World War II surplus motors or something, and you have to put them underneath the seat, and then you have to figure out a way to activate them, but you don't put them under every seat. You put them in like every third or fifth seat or whatever. So the people go, what's that? Why is that guy doing that?
Yeah.
And it was apparently very effective, but it was to talk exhibitors into doing anything more than put the poster up and put the,
or have
the
an
name
ambulance
on the marquee.
Outside the
yeah,
theater.
That's a big deal because they don't like to do that.
Well,
you know, it's
a
like
lot
too much
of time
trouble.
We sort of go through stuff and you figure, oh, they'll keep up. But there are going to be people who don't, because this is a big one. I mean, The Tingler, doesn't really matter about the, it's a Vincent Price film produced by William Castle, but they put these little generators under random seats in the theaters at appropriate times in the film.
They buzz people.
They would electrocute.
No,
Joe.
It's
they
not. They didn't electrocute them. They just, the seats move.
But also, it's an acid trip. I mean, he's taking acid.
Well, the movie is one of the most preposterous movies ever made.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
The plot is just nonsensical. Everybody treats it very straight, like it's really serious and happening, but it's ridiculous. But it's all planned around this gimmick, which was
just
not used in all the theaters. It was seldom actually really used because most exhibitors just didn't want to go to the trouble.
Right.
But the ones that were the ones that turned into a big box office hit were the ones who actually went and did the extra, went the extra mile.
Yeah.
Like in his previous picture, House on Haunted Hill, he had a lighted skeleton that would come up out of a box in the corner, and it would sail over the audience at a certain point. And the kids would throw candy at it, you know, and try
fantastic.
To shoot it down.
No
So not that many people used Emergo when they played the picture, but it was enough to get everybody talking about it, and it became a big hit.
Wow.
Well, plus, it's a fun movie.
It's a fun movie.
Yeah.
It is scary. But I do remember clearly that the setup is that, you know, this all happens, tapping into the fear by taking acid.
Right.
I mean, they're very explicit about it.
Is it literally acid or something?
No, it's LSD.
It's
the screen's first LSD trip.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which goes back to Corman again.
Yeah.
The trip.
Yeah. Yes. More LSD.
Yes, yes. Which Joe is a great script that he's going to make soon, right?
Sure, any minute.
About Roger Corman's experience making that film and having to do acid.
He did?
Yeah. Yeah, Jack Nicholson said, you know, he wrote it and he said, Roger, if you're going to make this picture, you've got to take acid.
That's a great
story.
And
so he did.
Yeah, it is.
And so we did it. We did a whole screenplay, which we've been getting close to making every two years. But it'll happen.
It's a joy to read. And there's literally, I'm sorry, this is a terrible thing to do. I'll say terrible things about you for the rest of the show, but there is nobody better to direct that movie than.
I have no doubt.
We did a live reading with Bill Hader as Roger at the Vista a couple of years ago, and it went off very well, and it convinced a company to sort of take it on and try to get it made. So we're still hoping.
I did a Roger Corman movie, and it was the kind of thing where working became a pragmatic thing because I have kids at the time and still do. Thank goodness.
Now that you think of it.
And so it was called Revenge of the Red Baron. And it was the screenplay was written by Mike McDonald from the Groundlings and Mad TV. Oh. And it had Groundlings in it, too. But at the same time, it was kind of garbage. And so I said to my agent, just name a price that they'll never meet. And they met it. So it starred Mickey Rooney, Cliff DeYoung, Ronnie Schell, and Tobey Maguire as my son. And it was a horrible experience just because Mickey Rooney was such a foul creature. And I don't want to get explicit because it is just so gross, the things he did in my eye line.
Oh, no.
When he knew it was my single. I just, oh. And his idea, I mean, in the dictionary under uncouth, Mickey Rooney.
We had Caleb Deschanel, who shot The Black Stallion on the show a while back, and he talked about there's a scene with Rooney and the kid having this intense conversation, and Mickey would, while he's talking to the kid, would every now and then reach over and pinch him so the kid would go like this, and he was trying to figure out what was going on, and they realized in editing he wanted to make sure that they couldn't stay on him for the entire shot, so they'd have to cut to him.
That is diabolical.
Well, when you've been in the business that long and start out as a child actor, you learn all the tricks.
Wow.
Yeah. That might be my favorite thing that I've learned doing this show.
Jeez.
Mickey Rooney would abuse a child to get a close-up.
Man. Insatiable.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. So what year was this Red Baron?
I don't even know. The 90s for sure. And really, it was literally a little red airplane with the puppet in it. You know, I mean, and it was, but I did get to shoot a gun. That was good.
It's fun.
Yeah.
Did you get at somebody or?
Yeah, well, at the plane.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, the plane.
The plane. Hey, so that was part one of our chat with Lorraine Newman. We'll be back with part two next week, but meanwhile, let's take a quick visit to the mailbag. Let's see. Molson Blue, this is a simple one, wants to know, who did the original movie poster artwork for Explorers?
Well, there's several different ones. If you mean the black tar paper one, that one.
Yeah.
I don't know, but if I knew who he was, I'd burn his house down.
Okay, let's go. Really?
It's a terrible piece of art.
He says it's a beautiful poster for Explorers.
It may be a beautiful poster on your wall, but it didn't look so good when it was plastered all over the fences in town and looked like black tar paper, and you couldn't see anything.
I'm sitting here reading this.
What are you
one?
Selling? There's an image. There's a fence. There's a bicycle. There's what, a skateboard?
A skateboard and a glowing light.
What the fuck is that? I mean, I'm sorry. It's just that is not the movie.
You don't need a driver's license to reach the stars. I'm so glad. Now I have to ask all of them because I was about to skim over that because I thought, that's a pretty simple question. That won't be. He'll just say, Bobo Rodriguez and we'll move on.
I have no idea. One of the most mixed marketed, unfinished movies ever.
Brian Ciano from Philadelphia. Brian Ciano, yes. What books would you guys love to make into a movie, and what books or writers do you think are really unfilmable? And if you're adapting a book, how do you decide to change a little or a lot?
Well, unfilmable, you know, there are a lot of books that are unfilmable as written, but most books, when they're turned into movies, are you either take two or three ideas and throw away the rest of it, or you just turn it into something else, or follow where it's going to lead. What was the first part?
What books would you love to make into a movie?
I was trying for years to make a movie out of The Sheep Look Up, which is by John Brunner. It's a science fiction movie about the future, which we're now in, so it's a little late. And I always wanted to make a movie out of The Screwfly Solution by James Tiptree.
Yeah.
And when I was at New World, I had a take on a whole script for it. And later I had a chance to do it as an episode of Masters of Horror. And it's only an hour long, but it turned out to be so depressing that I realized that if I had made it as a feature film, nobody would have come to see it at all. And the only way I could get it made was as part of another show that had other episodes in it. So nobody would like be able to pick up on this one and say, boy, this is really grim. I mean, it's about a plague that causes men to kill women. And there are things about it that are shockingly prescient in today's misogynistic society. Uh-huh. So it was a very interesting thing. It's the only thing I've ever done that has no humor in it.
Really?
Yeah, it's not funny.
Yeah, mine is. And there's a question later that I saw. So sort of it's a twofer. Sort of what's your favorite unmade project to date? I adapted a short story by Dennis Lehane called Until Gwen, which is today my favorite thing that I've ever written. I bought the story outright. I'm going to direct it. We've gotten close several times. It's an incredible, beautiful love story in the midst of a really dark father-son relationship. And an amazing, amazing short story all told sort of through it's told in the second person, and it's all sort of a memory piece. And some people have read it and go, how the hell would you turn this into a movie? But it's a phenomenal. I urge you to seek it out. It's in his book, Coronado. And it's an incredible piece of work, and still today, probably the best script I've ever written. English Dracula or the Spanish one, Joe?
I think he means the American Dracula.
The American one, Spanish, yes. One. The English language.
Well,
is Rupert Pupkin asking.
The Spanish Dracula is longer than the American one. It has a lot of interesting revelations in it, such as that the scene where Renfield is crawling toward the maid, in the Spanish version, it goes on a little longer, and you see that he's actually going to eat a fly that's on her face. But it cuts off in the American version, so you don't see that. Casting-wise, I think the American version is superior. I think Carlos Villaris is not as magnetic as Lugosi. I think Dwight Fry is much better Renfield than Jose, whoever he is. As shot by George Robinson, it's it really gives the Todd Browning one a run for its money, because after the first reel and a half of the Todd Browning one, it reverts to the stage play and therefore is very stagey. And the Spanish one manages to avoid that staginess, partly by there's sets that you don't see that much of in the Browning, you see more of. So I think they're good companion pieces for each other, but I, of course, you know, have a sentimental fondness for the original, because that's the one that I saw.
Yeah, yeah.
And also because of the way that it plays, and it's one of the slower movies of the early 30s. It's almost like everybody's in slow motion. It's almost like a dream that's taking place in another universe, because there's very little reality per se in the Browning version. And I think in the other version, they try to make it a little bit more contemporary, 1930s contemporary. So I think it's worth seeing both of them, but I would have to come down on the side of the Browning version.
I couldn't begin to elucidate it as well as you have, but yeah, I'd agree. I've only seen the Spanish one once when it first got released on DVD, and it was definitely.
It's a little sexier.
It was a great experience.
Although Helen Chandler is pretty hot, I think, and died very tragically. She was a very unhappy, mixed up girl, but really beautiful.
Here's one for Joe, but I'm going to answer it. Who is always phoning Joe, and why doesn't he just have his phone on vibrate? I'm going to say, obviously, adoring fans. And
I forget.
I've actually you're told supposed to turn it off. I love it. It's my favorite thing when that thing goes off. Also, what are your thoughts? Oh, this is from Jay Sutkawi. What are your thoughts on Tim Burton's Ed Wood? Is that a movie? I don't know what that is. I think it's a movie. Marcus Kempton asked, pitch us your unproduced dream screenplay, Josh Olson. And I just did.
Ed Wood, what do you want? You want us to say something bad about Ed Wood?
I think he's making fun of the fact that we always talk about Ed Wood. Oh. So my joke was, I've never heard.
Oh,
I wish Ed Wood had made a Tim Burton movie. That would be an interesting thing. Kevin L. Jones. This is a good question. Was it your idea? I was just talking about this today. Was it your idea to include a 69 scene in A History of Violence? I'll tell you two things. One, a friend of mine just noticed recently that a lot of sex scenes in my scripts all actually happen on page 69, which is not intentional. No, it wasn't. I did describe the individual acts. Maria Bello was such an amazing gift on that film. They all were, but I believe it was her who came up with the idea of combining them in the scene. And my understanding is it's the first American film. We are the last American film released on VHS and the first American film to include that particular act.
Wow.
So
for your resume.
Yeah. My mom's very proud. Joe, will Explorers ever get a Blu-ray?
I guess it doesn't have one, does it?
I guess not.
As Paramount said to me when I went back to try to find a way to reconstruct the picture, you're lucky we even released it.
Oh!
So I don't think that there's probably a lot of heat underneath the idea of doing a Blu-ray on that picture.
I guess no, because it was not a huge hit.
It was more than not a huge hit. It was a disaster.
But I have two Blu-rays of Matinee, which was.
Matinee wasn't a disaster.
Brian Burlingame would like to hear some anecdotes about Susan Terrell. I've got one. It's brief and it's really filthy. So, but I just remember, because I used to drive her to the set. My second job, I get to spend a lot of time hanging out with her. We would get there early sometimes.
No, not your second job on what?
On a movie.
Oh.
It was a Jackie Kong film called Night School. It came out as The Underachievers. Mm. Stars Eddie Albert. Susan was one of the people that I got to know her. She gave me a kitten, a cat, a little baby cat that I had
for
years.
Did she issue it from her loins? Or?
No, I don't think so. Although with her, you never know. But I just remember she knew everyone. She'd tell these amazing stories about traveling with Iggy Pop and hanging out with Fassbender and stuff. And I remember sitting in this bar one late afternoon on the way to this, before we got to the set. And she's talking about some show she did in Germany where she was naked on set, covered in animals, and the snakes writhing all over her body. And she's talking about and then one day I just took the snake and I just stuck his tail on my snatch. And it was like, they didn't even know what was going on. And she's just this nonstop barrage of filth, which was hilarious. And a guy at the end of the bar goes, hey, can I get a fucking drink here? And the bartender turns on him and goes, watch your mouth. There's a lady present. Which there was. She was a great lady. Best 70s noir. Oh, this is easy. Ray Gunn Chandler asks, Long Goodbye or Night Moves?
Oh, that's a tough one.
Is it really?
Well, I would say Long Goodbye.
Yeah, Long Goodbye. Fun one. Big, Beautiful Blast Furnace. Is a person asks, what are your favorite made-for-TV movies?
Made-for-TV movies. I guess that's a specific subgenre of movies, isn't it?
Yeah, Duel.
Well, Duel is right up there. Duel is pretty damn good. I think it's right up there with the best stuff that Steven ever made.
Yep.
They used to be so ubiquitous, those films.
Yeah, I mean, they were great in the series.
And now they're many of them gone public domain because some of the people who, Metro Media and all these companies that made TV movies, didn't even bother copyrighting them.
Well, Warner Archives have done a great job of...
they are. They're putting out a lot of TV movies.
Bad Ronald.
Yeah.
Is pretty glorious. I'm a fan of that. Of course, The Night Stalker, which ended up being a pilot, but that was that was pretty amazing. Does Homecoming count? I mean, it's an hour, I guess.
As a TV movie,
it was made for TV.
It's made for cable.
Okay,
it's a whole different world.
Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from The Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.